This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Professor Kwame Anthony Appiah, who is professor of philosophy and law at New York University and lectures frequently throughout the world. A leading moral and political philosopher, Professor Appiah is a prolific writer whose publications, both academic and popular, span a variety of disciplines. He also has published widely on the topics of African and African-American literary and cultural studies. In 2012, he was awarded a National Humanities Medal by President Obama. He is visiting the Berkeley campus under the auspices of the Graduate Lecture Series to deliver the Howison Lecture in Philosophy. Professor Appiah, welcome to Berkeley. Thanks. Were you born and raised?
I wish the answer to that was one place, but I was born in one place and raised in another. I was born in London, but where my father was a law student at the time, and that's where he met my mother, who was English. And then by the time I was about one, we were in Ghana, and I basically grew up there in the town of Kumasi, which is the capital of an old empire, Asante, which is now part of modern Ghana.
And looking back, how did your parents shape your thinking about the world? And this is a very complex story, so we're going to take a little time talking about it.
So my parents met in London. My father was a law student, but also he was president of something called the West African Students Union, which was an organization of colonial students from Africa. This is in the late 40s, early 50s. My mother was working for an organization that was actually called Racial Unity, which was run by the anthropologist Colin Turnbull. And they were working with colonial students to looking after their welfare in London. And so that's how they met. Well, I think the very fact that my mother, as a sort of upper-middle-class Englishwoman, was working on racial harmony in Britain in the 1950s made her a bit unusual, because it was still a somewhat... racist is the wrong word, but a moderately condescending towards foreigners, let me put it that way, was the sort of standard attitude. And she, you know, her father was the finance minister, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, so she came from a respectable family, and as did my father, whose father was the brother-in-law of the King of Ashanti, let's put it that way. So they came from these, in their each place, elite families, both of them places where there was a long tradition of sort of proud independence, I suppose. And each of them made a decision, as it were, to extend out when they were married, it was a sort of big deal in both societies. So the fact that they set off on this enterprise of what was a relatively rare thing at that point, which was a so-called interracial marriage, was a reflection, I think, of values that they both had. They were both very open people. My father had obviously traveled from Africa to Europe to be a student. He came to Europe by way of Sierra Leone. He was born in Ghana. And he had many friends, not just from Africa and from Ghana, but from South Asia and the Caribbean, other parts of the British Empire, what was going to turn into the British Commonwealth. My mother had traveled a fair amount. Her father had been the British ambassador in Moscow in the 40s, so she'd lived in Moscow. Her mother had been involved in raising money for Chinese relief in the late 40s, and so she had visited China. My grandmother is one of the few people who knew, not very well, but knew slightly both Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong, and my mother was with her on that trip. So she'd traveled a bit. She'd worked in Persia during the war. She was, you know, widely traveled. And as she told me much later in life, actually happier out of England. She never felt, despite the fact that she was born in the country, in England, to a very sort of normal family, as it were, she said that when she first got to Ghana, she thought, okay, I'm home. This is where I was supposed to be all along. So they were a bit unusual, each of them in their own societies, but they came from families that were open to the world.
So both came from established families in their national setting, but as you describe it, were really citizens of the world, or became that even early in their life, and then later, of course.
Yes. No, very much so. You know, for my father, the intellectual framing of this came out of one of those great 20th century movements, Pan-Africanism, which was very much a movement about working together across nationalities. It was about bringing together people of African descent from the Caribbean and Africa and elsewhere, people who were in other places, and allowing them to build together a new future for black people in the world. But that was not a vision of the life of the African diaspora as kind of excluding its neighbors, excluding other people. My father followed closely politics in Asia, in India and so on. He had a lot of Indian friends in London in the 40s and 50s. And actually my mother's family had a lot of Indian connections because my mother's father had been involved as a friend of Nehru's in negotiating the terms of Indian independence from Britain. So they were both sort of embedded in through family life and through their many friendships in a world that was very much a world of people from all around the world. And they enjoyed that, even though I would say they were both, interestingly, in their own ways, intensely loyal to a very local identity. My father lived in the city that he'd grown up in, even though he'd been in many other cities on the way. And he loved the city, he loved our traditions. He was a loyal servant of the king, who was my great-uncle when I was a child, and then his brother-in-law. And yet he was also a very active, patriotic Ghanaian, very active in the African Unity Organization, and for a while at the UN as a delegate from Ghana, very active in global politics. And he regarded all of these things as completely consistent with one another, just as my mother's deep attachments to Ghana never stopped her having a deep sense that she was also a woman who'd grown up in the west of England and who loved the English countryside and Wordsworth and English poetry.
What do you attribute their self-confidence and ability to be flexible in dealing with these multiple identities?
So I think it's different things. In my father's case, I think it was coming from this old imperial center. So the people in my hometown in Kumasi, despite the fact that they were defeated eventually by the British in the early 20th century, had a sense of themselves as people in the world who were entitled to the respect of the rest of the world. And they had done things. They had created a powerful culture and tradition and empire. They regarded, I think, the British as people who'd beaten them fair and square in warfare, but still not really their superiors. And after all, we only had a period of colonial rule that lasted. My grandfather was born before the colonial period and died after independence. So not many people lived just in the colonial period. It was a very short period in historical terms. So we hadn't been sort of bullied or pushed about too much. So I think that, and the town itself was full of people from everywhere because it was a major trading center. In the mid-20th century, it was the largest market in West Africa. And it had people not just from all over Africa, but it had Indians, people from the Middle East, Lebanese, Syrian traders and so on, Greek, timber merchants, all kinds of people from all over. And they all lived perfectly happily together in a framework set by the culture of Ashanti. So I think for him, he grew up around people from all over, and he was curious about them. And that's a temperamental thing; it's a matter of intellectual temperament. He was educated by Irish teachers, mostly Irish and Ghanaian teachers, and he acquired from that education a great interest in European culture. There were two books three books, on my father's bedside table. One was the Bible, another was the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius, and the third was something by Cicero. It wasn't always the same thing. He loved Cicero, he loved Marcus Aurelius, he loved his Bible. He thought of Kumasi as being, in many ways, like Rome. He used to say that, like Rome, Kumasi is built on seven hills. And he used to refer, when you grow up in Asante, at a certain age, you're allowed to wear a full thing. It's called a cloth, which is like a large piece of beautiful fabric, which you wrap over your left shoulder. And he used to refer to it as our toga. And so when I was first given one of these, he said to me, this is your toga virilis, which is the Latin expression for the toga of a man. So he very much sort of thought about Asante in terms derived from a classical education.
So he embraced the world while retaining closely the local identity.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, you know, I've always thought that the most misunderstanding of the slanders against cosmopolitans is that cosmopolitans are people who have lost their roots. And I think the best remark about this was made by Gertrude Stein, who said, what's the use of roots if you can't take them with you? So she was a Californian lady who undermined the metaphor of roots, but in the right way. My father never lost his sense of himself at Asante. He spoke the language, happily with his friends, and he was very good at speaking in it. He knew many proverbs, so he could talk in it like a traditional Asante speaker. But he would also quote, you know, as I say, Cicero or Horace to you, or English poetry that he loved as well, though not as much as my mother did. And he was... I think his openness to the world was rooted in his strong and confident sense that he knew where he came from and that he was happy that that was where he did come from.
And what about your mother's profile? It was in a different trajectory, but in the way ending up in the same way?
Yes. So I think, you know, I say that part of my father's openness came from the city that he grew up in. My mother grew up in a tiny village in Oxfordshire, so you couldn't say that. A very nice place. I've spent much of my childhood visiting it, and they're very nice people, but they were not cosmopolitan at all. Her parents were, though. Her family was. She knew her parents. When my grandfather was in the mid-30s thrown out of the British Labour Party for being too left-wing, one of the things he did was travel around the world. And so he was involved, for example, in the creation of the Jamaican Labour Party. And by the time he came to be involved as a member of the British Cabinet in dealing with Indian independence, he'd known Nehru for a long time just as a friend. Indira Gandhi and my mother knew each other when they were, 10 and 11 and 12, when they were kids. So my mother's family was, by British standards, quite, I would say, sort of non-racist. I mean, they had genuine friendships at a time with people who were not English or white, at a time when that wasn't terribly common. And as I've said, she was, because of my grandparents' involvement in Russia and China and so on, she had spent a fair amount of her childhood, and Jamaica for that matter, she'd spent a certain amount of time in Jamaica, in Moscow, traveling around in China, and she worked for a while in Persia, in Iran. So she had was exposed as a child and as a young woman to a wide variety of cultural experiences. I'm leaving out the fact that they spent time in Germany and Italy and Switzerland and Europe.
And so now let's go back to your story. You were born in England, did you say? And
yes.
Then, so where were you raised? Did you move from one of your parents' home to the other?
Well, so my parents were both in England when I was born, and when I went to Ghana, I went with both of them around about the age of one. And so our home from then on until I left college was in Ghana. They built a house, which is we lived somewhere else before that, but the first place I remember is this house that we still have. So they were, and at that point, my father was in Parliament, in the first Parliament after independence, in the opposition to Nkrumah, the first president, who had been a very close friend of his in London, but they had disagreed about political questions. And when my father came home, he didn't join the government party, he joined the opposition party. And this led pretty swiftly to serious break with Nkrumah. And by the early 60s, my father had been was a political prisoner. He'd been locked up. And in fact, my father had the good fortune to be put in, well, it wasn't good fortune to be put in prison, but it was a good fortune that when he was put in prison, Amnesty International had just been founded that year. And Amnesty, people don't remember this, Amnesty's first international trip was to Ghana. And so my father was one of the first prisoners of conscience. He was one of the first people that Amnesty helped to get out of prison because he was in for a year and a half. So he was very much involved in the political life of the country. And at that point, they, because he was and because my father was in prison, they tried to deport his wife and children just as a kind of harassment. My mother wasn't going to leave the country that her husband was imprisoned in. So she told them that they could try and get rid of her, but they'd have to carry her to the airport, and that was 150 miles away, and they didn't like the idea of carrying an English woman 150 miles, so they didn't do it. I was ill at the time, and quite ill, and just by chance, during the course of my recovery, I was in a hospital bed that the Queen of England walked by on her first visit to Ghana as a foreign head of state. And unfortunately, her husband, the Duke of Edinburgh, had been in Kumasi before and had met my mother. So when he looked back and saw the picture of my mother on the bedside table, he said, "Oh, give my regards to your mother." The president now knew that he was walking with a foreign head of state who knew that she had just talked to the child of a political prisoner. Mm-hmm. And he was really upset. And my doctor was was fired and various other things happened. And at that point, my mother thought, and it was all over the papers in Britain and Ghana. And at that point, my mother thought, better put this child somewhere out of the way because it's hard enough dealing with being with your husband in prison and being followed around by the security police. So I was sent to my English grandmother and put in a school near her house just to allow things to calm down. And I was eight. So from the age of eight, I was in English boarding schools with a home in my grandmother's house, but going home when my father was released eventually, going home for the vacations to Ghana. So I lived from then on at school in England and at home in Ghana mostly.
As a young person growing up, what was it like to experience these different worlds, but be comfortable in them?
Many people in England found my parents' marriage unintelligible. They couldn't understand how two people from what they regarded as such remote civilizations could possibly get on. And every time my mother went to England, the journalists would say, "Oh, so have you left him?" And she would say, "No, I'm just visiting my mother." And they stayed together until my father's death. And then my mother lived on in Ghana and died there. The answer is, I think, that it's if you are embedded in two extended loving families, it doesn't matter where they are. So we were very much at home in England. My sisters didn't spend as much time because they didn't have to.
And you have three sisters.
I have three sisters, and they're younger than I am, and they had the good fortune not to be ill and be visited by the Queen of England, so they didn't have to go through what I went through. But they, but we went often to see my grandmother. My mother obviously loved her mother and liked to visit her, and my English grandmother, by the way, visited us and knew Ghana quite well. So, and the house, my grandmother's house, was next to the house. It was in a village, but the house next door was my uncle Robert, my Aunt Teresa. My Aunt Teresa had been born in this village. Everybody in the village knew who we were. If I went into a store, people said hello. It was a very friendly place. No doubt, because it was a normal English community, there were some people who didn't like brown and black people, but they wouldn't have said so. So we were very comfortable there and in the village that my mother grew up in, which was, 30, 40 miles away. Where we spent Christmas very often. So And my mother's family, with one exception, and he was somebody I never met, were enormously welcoming. She did have one uncle who didn't come to the wedding, but you'll see why if I tell you that he emigrated to South Africa in the 1950s. So he had a very different politics from the rest of us. But the rest of the family, some of whom were quite socially conservative, were nevertheless, they weren't bigots. They were not racists. And once you're in the family, you're in the family. And the schools I went to, I was the head boy of one of my English boarding schools. And I was protected, as one is, by the fact that though my grandfather was dead, my grandmother was the widow of a prominent stateswoman. And I discovered after she died that she had written very stern letters to the headmasters of these various schools saying, if anything ever happens to my grandchild, you'll hear from me. So I was sort of protected in a way, in a way that everybody can understand by the fact that, I suppose you could say by class to a certain extent in England. So really it was not difficult. We were bilingual. My parents were both about Christians, so there wasn't a sort of religious issue. And I just never remember finding it at all difficult. The only thing I found difficult about England, and I can remember this to this day, is that when I first arrived there, when I was sort of 8 or 9, it was in the middle of the winter, and they opened the door of the plane, and I got out, and it was so cold. And I remember thinking, maybe this is a mistake. I can't believe how cold it is. So the weather was a problem to begin with, but I adjusted to that.
When one reads your many books, in addition to being very lucid, they have a narrative quality that really brings the reader in. Did this ability to tell stories, to give us narrations that explicate complex philosophical problems, did that come from your parents? I get the sense that both, in a way, were storytellers.
Yes, my father was a famous oral teller of stories. He wrote an autobiography, which is quite a good book, but that was his only big book project. People loved just to come and listen to him tell stories. And he told wonderful stories about his time in prison, which you would have thought was the most wonderful place in the world from the way he told stories about it. He apparently had great fun there, in part because he enjoyed telling stories to the other prisoners. He was a great narrator, and we would love listening to him when we were children. And the first fiction book that my mother published, and she became quite a well-known writer of children's books and then adult novels in Ghana, the first book she published, which Pantheon published in New York, was Tales of an Asante Father. So it was retellings of Ghanaians' folk tales that she had heard my father tell us. And then she collected more beyond that, and she published a whole series of them. So my father was this great teller of tales, and my mother was a novelist and a children's book writer. And more important, perhaps, than either of those, my mother was a great teacher of reading. Every time I came home from school, on my bedside table, she'd selected some novels that she really loved for me to read. It might be Tolstoy, it might be D.H. Lawrence, it might be Dickens. We were a bookish family. We had more books in our house than probably anybody else in our town. And many of the kids in the neighborhood would come and sit on the veranda and read, because we were a kind of lending library, because there wasn't a proper library nearby. And so it was a bookish place, and we read a lot. And I think, you know, when my students ask me how to improve their writing, I say, read more. Read good writers. That's the way you learn. You learn not by sort of drawing abstract principles, but by learning the feel of a piece, of a style of writing. And then you have to develop a style of your own. And if you read a lot and think a lot, you will. So I think I was lucky to be raised We were allowed during the summer vacations, I was allowed to retire to my room and read all day, and there would be a knocks on the door occasionally to remind me that I was due for a meal. But if I wanted to read, that was okay, and then I would be asked what I'd been reading. So I think it was a mixture of living among people who cared about narrative and also being exposed very extensively to narrative.
But before we talk about your formal education, I want to, in your book, In My Father's House, you end the book with his funeral. And in a way, that funeral is a summation of all we've been talking about, in the sense of the people who came, the traditions that were deployed in the undertaking of the funeral, even the internal conflict within the family. So touch on that a minute, because in a way, you're the very act of the funeral summed up all that we've just talked about.
Yes. I mean, I was writing this book anyway as my father was dying, and then he died, and I hadn't finished it, and I went home, obviously, and these things happened, which seemed so much to be ways of talking about the very issues that were at the heart of the book. So it's a very complicated story, but basically my father was head of his family. In Ghana, that means he was head of a group defined by shared descent, not from a man, but from a woman. So all his family, the word is Abusian, his family is all the descendants of his grandmother.
So it was matriarchal.
So it's a matrilineal family.
Yeah.
He was having a row at the time he died, whose content I never discovered, with his favorite sister, a woman I'd grown up with as someone I went to see all the time and who looked after me and fed me when I went to see her and gave me gifts and whom I loved. But they were not speaking. And she didn't come to see him while he was dying, and I think that was both a sign of how deep the rift was and also something that made him unhappy. So he wrote a will, a codicil to his will, close to his death, saying, I want my funeral to be conducted by my children. Now, in a matrilineal system, a man's children don't belong to him, and he doesn't belong to them, and the right people to conduct the funeral are his matrilineal kin. So this sister would have been the lead person. So he was sort of repudiating them. So I arrived back, and I thought, my father instructed us to do this. He's my father. I'm going to do what he wanted. I don't know whether it's a good idea or not, but he's my father, and it's his burial. And so it was very complicated to do that, to get it done. Because my aunt, his sister, obviously took this to be a public repudiation. She was the wife of the King of Ashanti, so it was to some extent a repudiation of the whole royal elite and so on. And just, as it were, getting his body, not, making sure that his body wasn't literally taken away by them, involved keeping it in a secret place and flying it up on a plane without telling anybody where we were going and so on. Anyway, we succeeded in organizing a funeral. Another thing was he had been president of the Bar Association, and the Bar Association, by tradition, buys a coffin for presidents of the Bar Association who die. And he had said to us, I want a simple coffin. Well, the Bar Association didn't want to buy a simple coffin for the president, but they wanted to. So we had another fight with the Bar Association. We said, we're sorry, but this is what he said, and it's kind of you to buy the coffin, but we want to buy the coffin that he wants to be buried in. So there were various things that it was as if he'd set us a bunch of tests.
Right. Which and actually, as you resolve these one by one, it's almost a test of your theory. That is, even when you're overruling tradition,
yes,
you are respectful of the tradition.
We're as respectful as we can be.
Yeah.
We're trying very hard. We're polite. Even my aunt's eldest son, who's now a very important chief in Ashanti, was astonished by the way in which my aunt spoke to me when I first came to her, as I was duty-bound to do, to tell her that her brother had died. And instead of, you know, consoling one another, she gave me a great lecture about his bad things he had done, which I knew absolutely nothing. So
this is just family everywhere.
This is normal family behavior.
Yeah,
but it was embedded in this context. And everybody in town, of course, because she was married to the king, was gossiping about it and so on. So we tried very much to do On the one hand, we hung together, my sisters and my mother and I. We were a matrilineal group, a little matrilineal group. On the other hand, we had many friends who stuck with us, including my mother's church, for example. And in the end, we were able to conduct a respectful funeral for my father, which was attended by the king and by the president and so on. And in the course of it, I learned a great deal about... I'd never done anything as an adult, really, anything important in the family context. And it was a baptism of fire. And by the time my mother died many years later, we knew how to do it, and also there wasn't a conflict going on. So my mother's funeral was a calmer, but also a respectful affair. And she had the privilege also of having a funeral where both the king and the president visited.
Now, the other part of your work demonstrates the rigor of analysis that you learned in philosophy. You got a PhD in philosophy at Cambridge. Mm-hmm. What was your work on in the beginning?
Well, in the 70s in England, both in Oxford and Cambridge, that's a terrible way of putting it because that suggests that there's nothing else going on in mm-hmm. England. But in philosophy, those were at that point the two main departments. And Oxford was much bigger. The central topics, the things that, as it were, the smart students were working on were in the philosophy of language. And I was interested in this anyway. I'd started reading philosophy of language in high school. We didn't have classes, so I just read it with friends and on my own. I ended up writing a dissertation that was about a set of connected questions in the philosophy of language which I thought you could illuminate by applying the mathematical theory of probability to thinking about questions in semantics. So the technical word for what the sort of technical part of it was that it was probabilistic semantics, which was a somewhat nascent field at that point. That also was drawing on tradition because Cambridge has the distinction of being the place where the major work in the philosophy of probability in England had been done in the 20th century. John Maynard Keynes wrote a treatise on probability, which is an important work. Frank Ramsey, his friend and colleague who died young, wrote probably one of the most important papers on the philosophy of probability in Cambridge. Ian Hacking, who's a Canadian but studied at Cambridge and who was one of my teachers, wrote a book, at least two really important books on the philosophy of probability. And my own dissertation advisor had written a wonderful book called The Matter of Chance, which was about the role of probability in physics. So I was well-trained to think about probability, and I was applying it to questions that my teachers hadn't applied it to, but where I thought it was useful. So that was sort of technical work, but the driving set of issues were not technical. They were issues to do with thinking about how you can understand the relationship between mental representation, the way we form and develop beliefs, and how we express them, and what is the relationship between language and thought, which is one of the old questions in philosophy, but applying these sort of rigorous technical methods to thinking about it. In the course of doing that, I became convinced that there was something that I could say about one of the big disputes that was going on in the field at the moment, which was between two broadly contradictory approaches to thinking about meaning, one of which derived from the thought that to explain what a sentence means is to say what the world has to be like for it to be true, and another had to do with saying, no, what's really important is in understanding the meaning of a sentence is figuring out under what conditions it's appropriate to utter it. And those are different approaches. I guess it's typical of me that what I argued was that there was truth in both of the approaches, and that the right way to understand the approach that dealt in terms of what conditions made it appropriate to utter sentences was to see that the task of sentence utterance is to say what's true. So the stuff about the world is important and the stuff about the mental is important, and you have to figure out the relations between them. That was a big dispute between so-called realists and anti-realists. It's still going on. And I wrote about the major figure on the anti-realist side, Michael Dummett, in my second book, and argue that he was wrong to reject the basic insights of realism. In the course of doing all this work, I learned something, I think, about how to do philosophy implicitly, though I didn't make it explicit to myself until much later, which was that my method, which I developed in doing this work, which derives from something that Frank Ramsey, whom I mentioned, the great philosopher of probability, had done, my method was to, when I was thinking about an important concept, was to ask three questions, which he always asked. When do we apply the concept? Having committed ourselves to its applicability, what does that make us do? And how does it interact with other concepts? Those are the three interesting questions I think about a concept. And basically since then, whatever I've worked on, I've tried, when I'm thinking about identity or race or gender, nationality, cosmopolitanism, I'm asking these questions about when do we apply the concept? If we apply it, what does that make us want to do? And how does it interact with other concepts?
I often like to ask my guests what skills are involved in what they do and what is the temperament as they offer advice to students. I think you've given us an idea of the skills. The temperament must be one of patience and flexibility and confronting what you thought were truths, which aren't truths.
Yes. I think you've got to eventually be willing to give up the things you started with. You know, I have a sort of joke that people on airplanes, if you sit next to them and you say what you do and you're foolish enough to tell them that you're a philosopher, they ask you what your philosophy is. And I used to say, well, that's not what philosophers are. They aren't people with a philosophy. But now I say I do have a philosophy, and my philosophy is everything is more complicated than you thought. And I think that that requires sort of both patience and willingness to change your mind, because you whatever question you start with, you have some initial intuition about it, and it may turn out to be wildly wrong, and you've got to be willing to face that discovery. But I should say that I think one of the powerful resources of the modern community of philosophy is that it's composed of people with many, many different styles of mind and many, many different temperaments, and that it's the interaction of people coming at things from many different angles that I think has sort of produced the modern efflorescence of interesting philosophical work. So, for example, I am really interested in taking things that I've learned in my discussions with other philosophers, including philosophers I read, and trying to make them available to a wider world of people who are not reading technical philosophy. And that, I think, is a really important role. But I don't think everybody needs to be doing that. And I think that if there weren't people doing the stuff that I read that isn't for the general public, I couldn't do what I do, because they're making progress in a way that depends upon proceeding with technicality and precision in a way that's just boring for most people who don't have a philosophical training and temperament. Nevertheless, their work can feed into the work of someone like me who is interested in... there's so much in the world that I think profits from a philosopher's helping the society to try and understand things. I don't think the job of philosophers is to tell people what to think. But I do think the job of philosophers is to provide for the society a richer and clearer vocabulary of concepts for thinking about things. I don't care whether my students end up believing, as I do, in the powerful value of liberalism. But I do want them to understand that liberalism is not the thing that gets talked about on the television, that there is a powerful intellectual tradition. And I want them to know what it is. I want them also to know what the critiques of it are. And I want them to know that there are other powerful intellectual traditions and that they have to make their own choices. In more, at a less abstract level, when people are thinking about things like racial justice, again, I think we need to have a society in which more people have a clearer picture of what we mean by race, what racism is, what's wrong with it. I think most people on the street in our society think that racism is wrong, but they couldn't give you a sensible answer to the question either what it is or why it's wrong. Well, we can't make progress in deciding whether a policy is racist if we can't tell each other a good story about what racism is. And the same thing is about many, when we're thinking about international questions. What obligations do I as an American citizen have for thinking about the welfare of people in Angola or in Bangladesh or in Russia or in Brazil or in China? Well, you need tools for thinking about that. It's not something that you're going to have a sensible line of thought about if you just take that question and don't have any framework for thinking about it. I think philosophers can provide the rest of society with useful ways of framing and thinking about concepts. But it's not my job to tell people what to do.
You've written one piece of your work is writings on identity and writing on cosmopolitanism and talking about the interface between the two. For you, and we've actually picked that up in the conversation about your own background, identity is based in the local, basically. And even when one thinks one knows what the local means or what identity, you really have to reflect on what those terms mean.
Yes. Look, everybody has the privilege of being born into at least one place. Some of us, like my family and I, were to some extent born into two places. But without doing any work as a normal human being, you're going to grow up with a strong sense of that place as part of who you are. You're going to know your way around a certain geography. You're going to know how to say hello to people in the place. You're going to know how to tell when someone's hostile and when someone's friendly. You're going to know that everybody around here likes skim milk and everybody over there likes their milk full of cream. I mean, you're going to know weird stuff about the local. And that's your sort of embedding in that locality is part of what the first way you learn to be at home in the world. So that's going to be, for most people, the start of who they are. But as my parents showed, you can have that deep sense of a place, which neither of them ever lost, and still go somewhere else for long periods, as my father did, or for the rest of your life, as my mother did, and build a life that starts with those roots, but then connects with another place or other places. And on the way, you'll get connected with identities that are not geographical. My identity as a philosopher isn't a geographical identity. It means that I can parachute into Tehran and find people to talk to who know what I'm talking about. It's a terrific privilege. When I go to Hong Kong or Sao Paulo or Paris, or I'm just thinking of places I've been to recently, or Abu Dhabi, in all of these places, it turns out, are all around the world, there are people who have this sense of themselves as philosophers engaged in a massive, long-standing global conversation about important questions.
When you talk about cosmopolitanism and you apply this rigorous analysis to what that means, you're really coming up with two propositions. One is that you have to care about the other, no matter what the national boundaries are. But on the other hand, you have to respect what they are.
Yes.
And the challenge then becomes negotiating that for you and for them. And I think you say that you use the term conversation in the sense of identifying with coming to understand the experience of the other. So then there can be conversation about where there is disagreement, how we might agree.
Yeah. Look, I think the key insight of the cosmopolitan tradition, going back a very long way, going back essentially to the beginnings with, Diogenes in the 4th century before the Common Era, is that the obligation, the fundamental moral obligation to understand that we must each do our fair share to make sure that every human being has a possibility of a decent life, so we care about everybody, has to be combined with the recognition that people are different and that therefore what the good life for them is different, and that to the greatest extent possible, we should allow people and communities to figure this out for themselves. Now, someone of a cosmopolitan, that's the sort of theory. But if you have a cosmopolitan temperament, you are interested in how the other people are working it out. You don't, I can't be a Muslim, I don't, because that requires beliefs that I don't find myself having. But I'm interested in how Muslims are handling the world. And I'm interested in recognizing that there are many, many different kinds of Muslims, from Morocco to Indonesia, in the old Muslim states, and many, of course, Muslims now in Europe and North America and Latin America. And that they're engaged, as I am, in an experiment in living, as John Stuart Mill again said. They're trying to figure out a way to live in the world. They have beliefs, they have practices, they have ideas about how to live. They produce art, they produce literature, they produce wonderful poetry in the case of Islam. Things that I can, that I value and can profit from. They also do things that don't make sense to me. I don't understand everything about every, I couldn't understand everything about every Muslim tradition. And they are, many of them, committed to things that I'm deeply opposed to. If I'm in a conversation with people from a Muslim society about whom, with whom I disagree about some important things, but with whom I can share my admiration for Rumi as a poet or for Umm Kulthum as a singer or whatever, and also our shared interest in soccer or tennis or Hollywood movies or Hong Kong movies or Turkish movies, against the background of that shared conversation, we can then come upon the things we disagree about and handle them more effectively. I think we can agree to disagree. We can find practical points of compromise without agreeing in theory. So one of my favorite examples of this comes from a British television program about teenagers, and I'm not going to remember its name, but in which there's a young man of Pakistani origin, a British Pakistani, who has a good friend of his own age who he goes to school with, who's English and white and gay. And the Pakistani boy's father is a very devout Muslim, and he won't tell his father, he's straight, but he won't tell his father that his best friend is gay. And they're waiting outside a birthday party, and the young gay boy won't come in. And the friend comes out and says, "Why are you standing outside?" He said, "Because you promised to tell your father that I was gay and you haven't told him." So the father comes out at this point and he says, "What are you doing outside? My wife has made your favorite Indian dishes." And he says, "Well, because your son hasn't told you something I asked him to tell you." He said, "Well, why don't you tell me?" He says, "Well," he says, "I'm gay." And the father looks at him and he says, "You know what? Islam is really important to me. I love my time in the mosque on Fridays, but I don't know everything. And here's something I do know. You are my son's best friend." That's not a concession about the wrongness or the rightness of homosexuality. That's saying, look, we live together in a world of people who have different ways of doing things, and I don't know everything, so I can accept and love you as my son's friend without our settling between us some, from my point of view, theoretical moral question. Conversable people who are in conversation with each other, can do that. They can continue to respect one another while disagreeing about something important, important to both of them. And I think that that is sort of a model for how we can live in the world, knowing that we won't agree about really important things. He's not asking the young man to accept that he's a sinner or whatever. He's just asking him to bracket it for the moment and accept that what's going on here is a birthday party at which family and friends are gathered together. I think that that's sort of a model. Philosophers often, one of the jokes about philosophers is that we say that works all very well in practice, but does it work in theory? But in many contexts, what matters is what works in practice. So philosophers who think that are, as it were, it's fine to pursue the theoretical question, but at a certain point, cohabitation is not a theoretical matter, it's a practical matter. And I'm just recommending that as one element of our armaments in the struggle to cohabit peacefully is to say, let's just talk to one another, not most of the time about the things we disagree about. Let's talk most of the time about soccer and music and art and science and the things that are interesting to us. Let's go fishing together. Let's go hiking together. Let's do things together. Let's be together in the world. let's work together to improve our children's schools, right? Understanding that we won't always agree about what they should be taught. Let's do all these things together. And then against that background, when I say to you, you know what? I think it's not good that you keep assuming that it's more important for your son to get educated than your daughter. You don't think I'm some hoity-toity, condescending stranger. I'm a friend of yours who's just expressing his view out of love for you and your children, and that's something you can accept. And by the way, of course, if you say that to someone, you should expect them to feel free then to say, well, okay, since we're talking about our children, do you really think it's okay that your daughter's dresses are so short? Don't you think that there's an ideal of modesty that's appropriate to women and to girls and so on, right? And so the conversation, it's not just about finally getting to the point where you can tell somebody off. It's about having a constant dialogue.
As I think back about your life and try to relate it to your research, what just struck me was that you were privileged to experience this cosmopolitanism, let's call it, and it just came to you naturally. And that what you're helping to do in your work is understand the complexity of these issues, because many people weren't blessed with the same background, and we have to work at it through thinking and analyzing and so on, and coming to a respect for the other. Yes. Is that fair?
No. I do feel that I've had a blessed life. I mean, I was incredibly lucky in my family and our circumstances. And I say this despite the fact that my father was in prison 3 times as a political prisoner, and I, you know, lots of bad things happened on the way. But the basic thing was, we grew up in a loving family that was in many places. And, you know, my sisters now live in 3 different countries, and none of them is the United States. So together we live in 4 countries. So, yes, I think, and their children, you know, I have nephews who speak Norwegian and English and German and Portuguese. I mean, one set of nephews. Not a lot speak English and Yoruba. So they have, too, this wonderful privilege. And I do think it's a privilege. And I think that the main thing that those of us who've had the privilege can do is to disabuse people of the idea that it's difficult, because against a background of a loving family, it's not difficult. And to disabuse people of the idea that there are sort of terrible intellectual challenges. No, there are wonderful intellectual resources, I think, that one derives from these things. Now, I mentioned the Amish earlier. I'm not saying that I have the sense... I think of my life as, in these respects, privileged. I understand that there are people have different temperaments, who want to live a more monocultural life. I understand that there are people who want to retire into a Trappist monastery and live a simple life as a monk, or a Buddhist monastery, or a nunnery. I understand that there are people who feel threatened in their village in Switzerland when somebody says they're going to build a mosque because they like it the way it is. They like the church of the one denomination, and they like the view of the mountains and so on. I'm not denying that any of that is real or that it should be wiped out. But I would like to talk. If they invited me to the village in Switzerland to talk, I would tell them about the pleasures of a different way of living in the world, a way of living in the world that I think works better now, given the way the world is. Look, one of the things that's happening in the world is that because of these now massive global conversations, though people remain incredibly different from one another, there are many points of convergence, right? So the people who were horrified by the treatment of that Jordanian pilot were not all in one place. They weren't all Jordanians. They weren't all English or American or Chinese. All around the world we have a shared sense now that which was the sort of thing that in this country crowds gathered to watch when they watched lynchings 100 years ago, right? It's not so long ago that we stopped doing things like that. There's just a developing global consensus. The same thing around questions of women's rights. You know, even in Saudi Arabia, which doesn't allow women to drive, there's a growing recognition that there's a point to the thought that the lives of women, like the lives of men, require large areas of freedom that women are entitled to, and so on. So the world is very diverse, and it's growing more diverse in some ways. There are new forms of diversity. But around certain important ideas, we're moving slowly and with great difficulty towards consensus. And that's the great achievement, I think, of the kind of human rights revolution, is to say, look, we can all live in our own ways. We don't all want to live in the same society. We want to have different countries, different nations, different political systems. But there are certain basic background assumptions about what human beings need to flourish that should be guaranteed everywhere. We can disagree about the boundaries of freedom of expression. In Germany, you cannot publish a copy of Hitler's Mein Kampf. It's against the law. In the United States, that would be an offense against the First Amendment. But Germany's history is different from us. We didn't build any death camps inspired by Mein Kampf, right? So you can sort of see, even if you're a First Amendment fundamentalist, you can see why in Germany this might be. But the thought that in Germany they should stop people discussing issues about the citizenship of Muslims, which they wouldn't do, well, of course they shouldn't do that. So, and we wouldn't think they should, and we wouldn't want people to not to be able to discuss that here. So there are local contours, I think, to these global values, but we're coming to a consensus that at the core of these things, these values are there. Even in China, where there's a problem now because they're increasingly making it difficult for people to express themselves freely, even in China, their constitution guarantees freedom of expression. Now, they interpret it in a way that I can't make much sense of, that we can appeal to them to live up to this value because it's their value as well. I'm not telling them, oh, you should live up to this value because it's in the UN Declaration or because it's in the United States Constitution. I'm reading an article of the Chinese Constitution that says that people in China are allowed to talk to the government about what they do and don't like, that guarantees them freedom of expression. I'm saying, we agree with you about that, so let's see if we can do it. And if you want to criticize us for failure to live up to this standard, go ahead. Because I'll probably join you. I don't think the United States is perfect in this respect. And if you want to criticize us about other things, go ahead. If you want to help improve the United States, remind us that we call ourselves the home of the free and we have a quarter of the world's prisoners. A quarter of the world's incarcerated people are in the United States and we only have 4% of the world's population. Anybody, anywhere in the world, looking at us and with our claims for freedom ought to be saying to us, we ought to be saying to ourselves, how did that happen? How did the home of the free become the home of the massively incarcerated? I think that people from other countries looking at us and asking us, not in a hostile way, but just in a friendly way, we admire America, but we don't understand this, is helpful to us, and we should be helping other people by asking similar questions about them.
Professor Appiah, I want to thank you very much for being on our program and helping us understand these complex concepts that can be seen as very simple once we actually analyze them. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.